And now, Forward with Falk. Join Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen as they navigate their way through the political thicket. Dave, I want to congratulate you because you've been admitted to practice before the Supreme Court of the United States this week.
Yes.
Not everybody gets that, right?
Not everybody. Basically, if you're a practicing attorney for a number of years, you can, and you have somebody to sponsor, you can get it. I don't, at this stage of my career, I don't think I'm ever going to have the need to use it. In my life, I've only had one or two cases that I thought even had the possibility of being heard by the Supreme Court. But my daughter also got admitted at the same time. So, but it's quite an experience when you do it in person there, and you're sitting there in front of the bench with all the justices and other people that are being admitted and waiting for the arguments that are going to follow. And it's also impressive when you go to the back rooms where you're waiting before you go out to the court chambers, and you see all the portraits of the previous justices and the busts that are in the great hall of previous justices. It's something. it's something. And you know that building is not that old. It's a 20th century building. Prior to that, the court used to sit in the Capitol.
Well, the day after you were admitted to practice at the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court came down with a very consequential ruling about voting rights, which effectively ended the Civil Rights Movement, ended the Voting Rights Act as an effective piece of legislation. And since the Voting Rights Act was what everybody considered to be the pinnacle of success of the civil rights movement of the 1960s, it effectively put paid to that success.
And I've said before, Chief Justice Roberts' life work has been to limit the rights of minorities to be able to vote, and he's done it through the law with some pretty dubious justifications. He wrote the opinion that had previously almost effectively invalidated Article 5 of the law by making the assumption or the conclusion that we no longer had to worry about civil rights when in elections, essentially, because black people had been elected to certain offices. And this one effectively guts Section 2 of the Civil Rights Act. Sometimes these things have different consequences. But this has been a project of the Republican Party. And it's an ongoing project to limit people's right to vote. You'll remember I've talked about them wanting to go back basically to Reconstruction days, to go back to Plessy versus Ferguson, without really admitting they're going back to Plessy versus Ferguson, where they're effectively saying is separate but equal is equal, even though in practice it isn't. But just by declaring it equal, they're justifying what they're doing. There's definitely going to be fallout of this, and it's essentially a heads white people win, tails minorities lose situation in the court. If you take into consideration race, if race was used in order to deprive people's rights, you can't use race to give those rights back.
According to the court.
According to the court, yeah.
Yeah.
because the best way to get, according to Roberts, get rid of racial favoritism is to get rid of racial favoritism. And they, you know, and they previously with what they were doing on a lot of these other cases that they've approved is saying gerrymandering is okay because it's politics, not race, even though it's race that's behind the politics. So,
but let me ask you, why is it good in politics? Why is that good?
Well, it's good if you can, if you're the majority and you can stop.
Oh yeah, that I see. I understand that. Yeah. But if you want to provide a level playing field, why is it good?
Well, who says they want to have a level playing field?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. You know, I withdraw.
Yeah, you know, this goes back back in the 70s, a Republican political operative, Richard Viguerie, you know, had that thing, we don't want people to vote.
Right.
He called them goo-goo, good government people. He said, when people vote, we lose. And we had the history of the previous Chief Justice, William Rehnquist, who in Arizona used to go to polling places to try to intimidate people. And the people he tried to intimidate, of course, were minorities. This is an ongoing project.
It's interesting to note that from the time of the country's foundation 250 years ago until the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment came into effect, there was not the first time there was a black representative elected to the Congress was in 1870. Immediately thereafter, the efforts to undo the Northern triumph in the Civil War began to be effective. The civil rights laws began to be attacked. The Supreme Court began to uphold the attack on the civil rights laws. And after 1870, no black person from the Southern states, the former Confederate states, was elected to the Congress until 1970. How about that?
100 years. Well, like I said, go back to Reconstruction, or the end of Reconstruction.
Yeah, that's it. That was the end. That's exactly right.
You know, and you get the Republicans now, a guy like Dinesh D'Souza, who's been really heavily criticized for he used to be a rising star, intellectual star in the Republican Party, but he's been heavily criticized for the things he's done. He goes and says, he reminds people that up until the 1960s, it was, that throughout the Civil War era and the post-Civil War era, it was the Democratic Party that were anti-black. What he forgets is that things started to change in the 1940s. Remember that Hubert Humphrey introduced a civil rights plank into the Democratic platform in 1948. Harry Truman integrated the military, and it was still opposed by the Southern Democrats, who Roosevelt needed for his coalition. But by the 1960s, the parties had switched. And after George Wallace's minor successes in garnering votes, the Republicans under Richard Nixon saw the light and essentially became the party that opposed racial preferencing and what have you.
But also all the Democrats from the Southern states quit and joined the Republican Party.
Yeah. Yeah.
Strom Thurmond was a Democrat. Then he was a Dixiecrat. Then he was a Republican.
Republican. Yeah. Yeah. And that's the way it's pretty much stayed since.
And that was Nixon's strategy, the Southern strategy.
Well, it was Kevin Phillips' strategy.
But it was enforced by Nixon.
By Nixon. Kevin Phillips later, I think, regretted.
He did. He renounced it. That's right.
Yeah. He renounced it. But he formulated it. So,
But the thing about the Supreme Court voting rights case, not only does it mean that minorities throughout the country, especially in the southern states, will undoubtedly lose their representation, it also means that the Democrats find that the calendar is rigged against them again.
Right.
That the representation is rigged again. Trump does not stop trying to rig the elections one way or the other. He's got 10 things up his sleeve, and he keeps at it constantly. And this is one of them. And you say, well, the court did this. But the court is, in this case, the arm, the tool of the MAGA movement.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's had three appointees to the court. Plus, you have Thomas and Alito, who came before, and Roberts, who came before.
But I want to ask you, as a new member of the bar, I don't understand what gives the court the right to make the decision that they made, which was that they have the right to decide on policy. Their decision, Alito's argument, is there is no racial discrimination anymore because blacks registered to vote. Before, they weren't allowed to register. He gets away from Roberts' thing that they did, that blacks are getting elected. He doesn't care about getting elected now, because Alito's argument is, what if none of them get elected? The point is they can register, okay? Therefore, this attempt to make sure that the civil rights of people are protected no longer exists as a right. That's a policy decision. If it's proper for the Supreme Court to have decided that the Voting Rights Act was constitutional when it was passed, it's irrelevant whether the conditions that call it into being still exist. It's still constitutional for it to be on the books.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. The constitutionality was independent of the underlying fact.
Yeah. And Sotomayor, I think, it may have been Kagan, but it may have been Sotomayor, quoted Ruth Bader Ginsburg in her case, in her dissent against Roberts so many years ago, when she wrote that this decision says that I have an umbrella, and because I'm dry and it's raining out, I can throw away my umbrella because I'm dry.
Right. Well, Kagan issued the dissent, and she talked about cracking, which is one of the ways. There were two ways on congressional districts that that this thing worked. One was packing, where they would take, and essentially that's what the Louisiana had been trying to do for the second black district, was to pack it, take as many black people from as many different places and put it in one district, and then leave all the other, which leaves all the other districts lily white, so to speak. The other thing was cracking, where you disperse everything. In other words, you have an area that's heavily black, but you now cut it up like, you know, like you're cutting up a pie. And so there's a few minorities in every single, in four or five other districts, but not enough to make a difference because they're not concentrated anymore.
There's a way to overcome all of this, and it's completely within the power of the Congress to do it, and that is to do away with districting. I know people argue we should have fair districts. How about it's implicitly impossible to have so-called fair districts. If you do away with districting, you have fair elections, because people then have the chance to be represented in proportion to their vote, to their interests. If 10% look at it, things one way, 10% of the people who are elected to Congress or to whatever legislature are there. And if it's 30%, it's 30%. And what have you?
Well,
and you can certainly do that.
There's a different approach to being done. Before I get that, I just, you know, the Republicans are saying, well, look at Massachusetts. There's 9 votes and none of them are Republican. Okay. So it can't be fair. But there, it's not because of gerrymandering. It's just because the way the populace is. But the new thrust to kind of overcome this is to expand the number of members of Congress. It's been fixed at 435 for a long, long time. I think going back to the 19th century. And the population of the United States has expanded greatly, which means that each congressperson represents more and more people, and so they're further away from that. If you're now, you know, what is it, about 700,000 or more? You know,
about three-quarters of a million, right?
Yeah, three-quarters of a million people in each congressional district. Well, if you double the size of Congress, you're down to three, you know, they're much closer to the people.
And it would give Trump an opportunity to build a beautiful new Congress building.
Yes. Yes. Instead of the Rayburn building, we could have the Trump Towers again, another
yeah,
Trump Towers.
Exactly.
I just want to make one little comment here. It's not really as relevant to the argument, but sitting there maybe 25, 30 feet away from the members of the court, looking at them, Alito looked awful old, and surprisingly so did Kagan. They just, neither of them looked really hale and hearty. The other justices were and they did take part in the argument. I was really amazed at the argument that I heard, which is an accountability argument, how animated the court was, how well-informed the court was, and the lawyers who were arguing for, and how everybody was really, really into their questioning. They were doing their job, let's put it this way. Whether they were coming out with the right outcome is a different story, but they were, you know, they were well prepared, and it was impressive to hear them do this.
Yeah, but they were. But at least you're right. They may have been doing technically a very fine job. The question is, were they and could they, can they, properly vet the laws, you know, of the country?
Yeah,
is that what they should be doing?
Yeah, you know, the. The argument that I heard, because it relates to some of the other things that we're going to talk about, was an accountability argument.
What does that mean, accountability?
Well, don't forget, my messaging guru, Frank Luntz, says accountability is one of the words that work. It's one of the three arguments that I think politically are very important, along with safety and transparency. But the case was whether or not a private company, Cisco Systems, could be held accountable, could be sued for aiding and abetting, in this case, the Chinese government, in the Chinese government's attacks on that religious group, that Falun Gong.
Falun Gong.
Yeah. And I guess by providing them with systems and things, they facilitated what the Chinese could do. It's sort of like what's been talked about, what IBM did with the Nazis, you know, providing them with better ways of mechanizing their discrimination and treatment of Jews and minorities. As a matter of fact, the person defending the right to sue opened up his opening statement by reference. He said, you know, under the theory of the petitioners, Nuremberg couldn't have happened. Cisco, of course, had its own lawyer, but the government weighed in on Cisco's side. I couldn't tell, though, which way because it was a very narrow technical argument under a specific statute, where the court was going to wind up. But
why does the court have jurisdiction?
Well, because there was an act of Congress, and this going back to the 1700s, saying that one of the acts was the Torture Victims Accountability Act, or Torture Victims Something Act. And in three instances, it had to do with a lot with piracy and things that happened. But there were three specific instances that the act said people could be sued. And the technical argument was whether aiding and abetting was a separate instance, or whether it was just a derivative of one of these three things. But you know, the accountability came up again this week in another argument the day after we left the court, and that was it's also breaking against the MAGA movement. It's the MAHA movement, and these were people that were very you know, pro Bobby Kennedy because of his attempts to, if you want to, for one word, purify food and food processing. And this was a case against Bayer, which had bought out Monsanto, whether they could be sued for their weed killer Roundup and the consequences of it. And again, the MAHA movement was very upset with the Trump administration because they were taking the position of the company rather than the accountability argument. So, and we've seen a couple things now weakening the MAGA movement. That being one of them. There's a counter MAGA movement that says make American gas affordable, MAGA. Sort of co-opting the acronym of the MAGA movement, and you know, in the polling across the country, this is, you know, the affordability issue is huge right now, and that's weakening the position of the administration as well. So we've seen all of that.
It strikes me that the Supreme Court justices and many of the right-wing judges routinely do what they attack their opponents for doing, which is legislating from the bench.
Oh, of course.
And I mean, and that's the basis for this ruling in the voting rights case. They don't like the policy.
You know, they've pushed, this is what messaging is important, because for years and years and years and years, their message was that the court is making law, it's not interpreting law, whatever. And then when they've got the majority, and they have a solid majority now, they are making law. But they've sort of insulated themselves by labeling themselves through their messaging as the party of interpretation, not legislation. There's a parallel.
Well, they should be called out.
Yeah, and you know, you have to, but that's going to take counter messaging, and it's going to take time.
Yeah,
over counter messaging, on that that type of thing. There's the other parallel about spending. You know, the Republican Party is supposed to be the party of fiscal responsibility. We've got to rein in spending. It's the Democrats that are free spenders, and of course, what we've seen is that it's the Republicans that are the big spenders. That remember Donald Trump in his first administration blew open the national debt. He increased it by 25% of all the accrued national debt in the history. And the last three Democratic presidents have been the ones, Clinton, Obama, and Biden, that have lowered the debt. And now under Trump, the debt has exploded again, under Trump too.
And it's going to go up even more, because he's asking for $1.5 trillion.
We're the responsible party. Now there's the theory that what the Republicans do is they spend so much money that when the Democrats get into power, that they don't have anything to spend. So they can't favor their social programs. And
that's not a theory. That's actually true.
Well, pointed out. So that, so that's there as well.
I want to go back to court practice, because I'm annoyed. We had not in the Supreme Court. It'll get to the Supreme Court, but it's not there yet. But the Fifth Circuit Court, which is a southern a federal court located in the South.
Yeah, very conservative court.
The most conservative of all the federal court circuits, right?
Right.
Came out this on Friday with a ruling about mifepristone, the drug
that the morning after.
The morning after pill, which is used in 60% of all abortions in the United States, and which you can get in any state by getting a somebody to mail it to you. Doctors have the right to mail it to you. Texas passed a law that said the doctor who mails it to anybody in Texas is committing a felony in Texas, and they tried to get a New York doctor extradited to Texas to stand trial. New York refused to do the extradition. This is a case that was brought in Louisiana. Louisiana claimed that it was illegal for this pill to be mailed, sent through the mail, because Louisiana was damaged. That's on the basis of which it sued. And what was their argument? It said Louisiana is, because you have to have standing, right? You have to show that you're injured. So they argued that Louisiana is injured because allowing this pill to be dispensed remotely directly causes unlawful abortions in Louisiana and therefore harms Louisiana as such. Now, that's preposterous. But that's exactly what the court agreed to and ruled, that the nationwide you can no longer, and it was effective as of Friday night, no longer can mifepristone be transmitted through the mails.
Well, you know,
barring abortions in states where it's legal. Taking the right of abortion away from people who have that right, even though they don't live in Louisiana.
Yeah, but the other thing that this does is it allows a single district in Louisiana to govern the whole country, which the conservatives and the MAGA people were opposing when single district judges made rulings to stop them from doing things in immigration that affected the whole country.
And they outlawed it, right?
Right. They said a single district can't do this, and now they're saying, except in Louisiana, we'll let a single district make this ruling.
Yeah, except in abortion cases where they're going to rule against abortion, the right of abortion. Which is really against the rights of women. This is not an abortion matter. This is a matter of the equality of women in the American society.
Again, turning the clock back.
Yeah, exactly.
But I want to make one other comment. This week we had the King of England came to Congress and addressed the Congress. And the irony in this year, the 250th anniversary of the United States of America, where our country rebelled against a tyrannical king and said that people should have rights and the government had to be accountable to them, to have a King of England stand before Congress and remind people that that they should stand up to tyranny and that we needed accountability through separation of powers as ensconced in our Constitution, I thought was somewhat of a great irony. And, in many instances, he got a standing ovation even from the Republicans. Which I think was more, they really didn't understand what he was saying.
I think you're right. They didn't know what he was talking about.
But it, we continue to have these things go on.
Well, there's a lot of stuff that happened this week we couldn't get to. We're done with our comments for today. But we'll have to return to them. There's a lot that happened this week. And even if nothing happens next week, we've got plenty. There's the Comey indictment again. There's the government proposing to lift the broadcast licenses from ABC because they don't like jokes that Jimmy Kimmel makes.
We have the situation in Maine with the Democratic Party.
Precisely.
Precisely.
And what that means for Chuck Schumer and the Democratic Party. Exactly. So there's a lot we have to go back on to, and we will go back on to. But for now, we're done.
Well, no. Have a good week.
Have a good week.
You've been listening to Forward with Falk. Longtime Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen discuss politics. Join them again next week, same time, same place.